Anyone have something to ask or say?
So I woke up in between.
Yeah.
It just, well,
what we did.
Yeah.
We kind of did two different ones, actually. And the first one was the breath and feeling the different phases of the breath and the quality of each phase and how that quality might be a helpful kind of lens to look at our life. What phase is happening? With a sense of the naturalness of there being phases. Not that we should always be in a feeling of fullness and abundance, but sometimes we're empty and that has a completeness to it, naturalness to it. And then we let a small but vivid, difficult thing come to mind and feel it and let it come in like a lost puppy, like to welcome it in, and letting the response also come out of us as it would with the lost puppy on a rainy day. And then expanding it, so which means taking the ownership out of it. So even if it was my embarrassment, I didn't create embarrassment, I didn't ask to feel embarrassment, etc. And I'm not the only one who's ever felt embarrassment. And right now on planet Earth, there are probably a few million people feeling embarrassment. And if we include animals, sometimes we feel that they could also feel embarrassed. And it's just this very specific experience that's not so secret anymore. And then we have more access to a wide heart that could say, okay, yes, come in. We feel where the heart just naturally says, come in, instead of our habit tendency of trying to keep it out. And when we let ourselves say, come in, then there's this warmth and the natural, like we would dry off the puppy or whatever, give it some water. And then starting to ride on that texture of what would be offered through a human being to a lost puppy. And letting that fill and overflow. And then it's also taking into consideration that not only is the difficulty something that we all share, and so the story somehow loses its importance, the story that triggered the feeling, but the ability to welcome and the response that comes have an even kind of almost greater dimension of not being mine, but something that I love. Even if I also am afraid of that capacity to welcome and respond, apart from a sense of obligation, completely apart from a sense of obligation. And it might be that doubt that we're able that actually wield such a big heart. Like we think it'll be too much for us. And then we've disconnected from what we really, we've left our place where we feel we belong. and we keep trying to get some kind of safety instead of this other response that says, lost puppy, come in. Even if you might like have fleas and you might shake the rain all over my house. And your owner might be someone I don't want to meet. And because we have very often taken on too much, trying to be a good person, we have good excuses for not letting this warm welcome happen. But it's two completely different responses. The warm welcome is something different from the taking on too much responsibility and then regretting and resenting it. And just because I use the image of a lost puppy coming in, it doesn't mean every time you see a puppy looking a little wet, you should like go over and like, if we cannot take things so literally, but the responsiveness. So sometimes we see a situation, we could say of danger, like, so the puppy's in danger. And my response to the puppy opened me to the unknown in a way that I hadn't planned on, because I was just going to go buy groceries or whatever, and it's a puppy. And we're also more in danger of awakening, because we've gotten out of our doing mode, and there's a response. So we need to reawaken our potential responsiveness when we know we're in danger, so that we're not just constantly trying to get away from danger. In these ways that don't really work. So sometimes the response to danger would be to do something immediately, to either like grab the puppy and get the phone number and pass the puppy as fast as possible. Another response would be take it inside and all of that. Another response to danger is to know to stay still. And ask for some advice. So that help can come. So to know that the situation is beyond us. And to find a way of not like forcing ourselves, not pressing forward in that, and not just postponing. So yesterday we talked about the stuckness or paralysis of sloth and torpor, and the perpetual motion of restlessness and guilt, we could say. And I suggested that we could feel whether they're always together, a stuckness and a restlessness, a compulsive movement. So this place in us that would know not to force ourselves on the situation, but would also know not to, would be able to feel when we're postponing, when we just need to face something, is a kind of life skill, again, maybe that we could learn when we're 5, 13, and 22, and then have refresher courses. Compulsively pressing forward, like taking literally that I should go out and save all the wet puppies, would be the restlessness, the slavery, the not being able to stop from saying and doing. And the postponing would be the sloth and torpor. The postponing would be not quite being able to bear letting something wake up, get unstuck, like the way a leg, we say it, letting it wake up after it goes to sleep. So it's lost circulation. It hasn't had full circulation. And it's not so pleasant to let it wake up. But we do want our leg back. If it's been asleep a really long time, we might have gotten really used to hopping around and we think we're fine, no problem. I can deal with it, leave me alone. So if we notice we're restless, we could ask ourselves what is stuck or what's not receiving lifeblood. What am I kind of postponing? What am I not wanting to wake up? We want it to stay in hibernation, the hungry bear. And also with restlessness, it bears saying, maybe also that movement has an intelligence in it, that unstoppable movement. Like, there's a story that I seem to need to tell today that I was trying to, I've been postponing it all day, all week. And the end of the story is riding in an army truck in India for a long, long, long time. And so that image came to my mind, and I thought of, like, if there would be sacks of potatoes in the back on this really bumpy road, not paved, and this really bumpy truck with, I don't know if it had any shock absorbers or not. With that motion, what potatoes would fall out of the sack? Like, maybe sometimes there's a kind of movement that wants to happen, and if we can stop our compulsive movement and just let the movement come out, what would come out? And when we're more aware of the sense of being stuck or paralyzed, more aware of a sense of spacing out every time something important comes up. So when we're stuck, we could try to feel like as if we had some antenna in the back somewhere, trying to feel what is speeding up as this postponement goes on. What is starting to speed up in my life? Getting a wider view of your life and feeling, as I'm postponing, what's getting too much energy? And also, where's the shame? And then, of course, is there a need to be ashamed of this? It can be confusing to try to feel the different threads in the knot, K-N-O-T, knot, the tangle, around safety and stress and the thrill of aliveness. So we want to have a scent on retreat of being safe enough that we can relax. And as we relax, we start to feel where in our system there's a way that we're on. So a way that even when I feel safe, something isn't feeling safe. Something's on guard, defensive, protective, armored, or just on. We could even talk about it in the language of stress. Because stress just means we don't feel safe. That's all that it means. We talk about it so much that we don't really think about it anymore. It's become a way of life, but it just means we don't feel safe. And like other drugs, that chemistry in the body is addictive. And we get so used to feeling stress, we get so used to feeling unsafe that we forget what would be normal for a human being. And so we go through a process of finding what helps us feel more at home, belonging, and that that kind of shock or on-ness in us can start to let go and see that it's unnecessary and just exhale itself, dislodge. Part of that process has something to do with memory, which is another one, the one that I haven't mentioned from the Yoga Sutras, of the one translation calls them the five vibrational modes, which I really like the translation. It's usually translated as waves or fluctuations, but I like this translation, the vibrational mode. It makes me feel like those images that we had way long ago in physics when I was young, where there would be energy added to an atom, is it? I don't even remember now. And the pattern of the electrons would change pattern and size. And then if energy would go out, it would go back to that other option. And if we would add more energy, it would go again to the next threshold. So these vibrational modes of the mind that stop us from experiencing our not separateness. And memory is the fifth one on the list. So we had the snake rope thing. We had imagination and delusion. There's also sleep, which we didn't talk about. It's another vibrational mode, so it's another human experience that's the closest one to being so relaxed that we can actually experience what is, but it's not quite, as we know. We're asleep, and the eye is not functioning, so that's not in the way, but there's something that's not quite. It's not that it has to be. We could be awake in sleep. We will be someday, I venture to say, but usually when we're in deep sleep, not dreams, but deep sleep. There's a kind of, our sensitivity is not available in the same way. And so memory is a vibrational mode, and there was a really nice translation also. Yeah. The vibrational mode that's not allowing sense impressions to escape. So when memory is blocking our true experience, our direct experience of what is, which includes a not separateness, then what's happening is that sense impressions are not allowed to escape. The way we might talk about it in our more current kind of pop psychology would be that the shock has made an impression on our system from intense or repeated familiar events. And so we keep experiencing what we once experienced. And there can be a kind of way where I want to stand guard by that got hurt so it doesn't happen again. But meanwhile, the standing guard is not letting the sense impressions escape. And if we could feel how that got hurt might just need the sense impressions to escape now, so that we could incline towards its whisper. We could be more obedient in the way that we've been talking about to that vulnerability. What do you need? If we can notice what's speeding up, what's getting postponed, where's the shame? What are we afraid of its awakening, of its coming back to life? Not pressing forward and not holding back. What that means is one of the statements of one of my teachers, Ajay, who's also an Open Dharma teacher with us, that makes more and more sense as one of the deepest teachings I've ever heard. It's don't freak out. And I still giggle every time I hear it or say it. And I also, over the years, start to realize how fundamental that is. It's also what I mentioned yesterday with Robert Fripp's experience of music, this practicing relaxation so that our sensitivity can receive the creative impulses, the spontaneous response of now, whether it's cutting off the thought without a thought or letting the thought have space. And I just, it's really a weird thing, but there's a little baby badger on the road here, if you want to stand up and see it. I don't know if there's a meaning or whatever, but it's been hanging around today. It just walked onto the grass near the road. It's probably freaking out right now, running back to the... And it's cute little... Not quite freaked out. Still by the road. If you didn't see it, there's still time. It's about to go into the forest. And it just went in. Sorry. It's just a weird little moment today that I was resting and then I heard this bird talking and it got my attention. And I don't know much about bird calls or anything, but I was getting that there's something wrong. And so I went out to see if I could be of help. And it flew away. And then I went back inside and I was at the kitchen sink and I looked out the window and saw the bird and the badger right there. And I don't know why and I don't know if we can be of any help, but it felt really right to go outside anyway, not having any clue what kind of bird it is. I didn't even know. I was like, is that a possum? And Gyan was like, I think it's a badger. I think it's a baby badger. It's like, you're right. So there's also the fifth imperfection that obscures wisdom from the Buddhist tradition, the fifth of the so-called hindrances, which I also call signs of breakthrough, because they seem to happen when we're already kind of trickling past the obstacle and getting in touch with something deeper that does want to wake up now, that does want to stop being ashamed and postponing and transferring its energy elsewhere in our psyche. The fifth one, so we had... The first one was lack, not enoughness, or greed, with the metaphor of debt. The second one we haven't talked about. I can just mention briefly that it's called ill will, and so it covers a lot. And I really love the phrase ill will to cover all of that. And the metaphor is illness also. Being so weakened by an illness that our food doesn't agree with us, so whatever nourishment and help might be there can't get in because we're that sick. And then, of course, we get better and we're glad, as the way the text goes. Then there's sloth and torpor, which is like being in prison, which to me is much worse than like being sick or in debt. And then even worse would be slavery, which is the restlessness and guilt. And the fifth one is doubt. And it's compared to being a wealthy person going on a journey across a desert. So it's a really completely different kind of metaphor, which I think is really appropriate. When we get across the desert and there's been no damage to ourselves or our property or anyone on our kind of team or whatever, we're glad, just like we were glad to get over our illness and get out of slavery and get out of debt. But what is that journey through the desert? And why do we have to do it? I think that doubt is really important, even though it also is crippling. When doubt is a stuckness, so when doubt is a prison, when it's taking over, so we've lost our way in the desert, we need to really get familiar with what that feels like, when doubt is running around in our head and it's that whirlpool that we are getting sucked down into. We need to get familiar with what that feels like so we know this is that kind of doubt that seems to make sense at the time and later doesn't, and we need help. And having maybe, it's kind of like if one time Jan went with an aunt and uncle and cousin to a big Christmas parade, and so he wrote the phone number on his arm. It would be like, this would be a list, what helps me no matter what, like write it on your arm. Especially if you're going into a situation that's likely to bring up your insecurity. Have it in your back pocket, have it in your, on your arm, on your hand, the back of your hand, the front of your hand, everywhere. What is that phone number to call home? But many times when we're in doubt about our abilities or what we have been doing that we thought was helpful, but maybe it isn't after all, and did we just waste 10 years? It's really hard to think of actually making the phone call. So do. But when you don't, know that it's one of these really common experiences that we kind of go through. I don't know if we can say we have to, but we go through. And it's like being a person of wealth going through a desert. And I love this image of going through a desert, being a person of wealth. And it almost echoes with that first one of being in debt and having a business and making enough money to have a family. So then it's maybe like you've already done a lot of good things that were helpful to you and others, and you have a certain momentum, and then there's this desert in the way. And your best guess is that you need to get across it. And you've got this kind of family that you've agreed to support, like you said, come on, we have enough. And I wasn't really planning on the desert here. Sorry. And there's not any water anywhere. That's the one thing about deserts. And that's the thing about doubt, is how it's drying us out. The badger's back, in case you want to get it. If it's a badger, Gan says so.
I think it might be the woodchuck that lives
under. A woodchuck, yeah. Live under the shed. Not a baby badger.
I think it's not a groundhog.
He's not a baby.
It's a big woodchuck, not a baby badger. There's a TV show that Jan likes to watch that they talk about having a hypothesis and finding out if your hypothesis is correct or not. And he said, his hypothesis that the animal was digging, he said, my hypothesis is wrong because we saw it was eating. And now he'll probably be okay that his hypothesis about the baby badger was wrong too. So this is positive doubt. Maybe it's a baby badger, but anyone have other ideas? A grown-up woodchuck. It's important to get to know the real difference in feeling between destructive doubt and helpful doubt. Helpful doubt is a kind of openness that might be really shaky because you might really want it to be a baby badger, because that would be this really great story because of the thing you have for badgers or whatever. The doubt this week that maybe most of my life is fear driven. Maybe there haven't been so many moments of letting love decide for me. To realize that that's an insight, a freeing insight, that that lets you out of prison and slavery and debt and illness. If we don't let it turn on the small doubt, so in the Zen tradition they talk about small doubt and great doubt. Small doubt is easy, like maybe I'll never get it right, and it feels heavy. But it is also kind of easy. It's a certain kind of safety. It would be like being in the middle of the desert, and maybe you're lost, maybe your water's about to run out, maybe you hear someone rustling, and it could be like a leopard or some robbers, and you're unprotected. And it would just be easier to die. That's small doubt. It sounds really brave, like, oh, I'll just die. And there's a way that it's just too easy. Especially when we remember that we've brought others along with us. What are they going to do if we give up? And how can we let that be an encouragement rather than a support, like something that gives an inspiration to connect with our staying power instead of a further heaviness that just drops us into the sand face down? A journey across a desert means that we need to keep going. And if we know that we've kept going in a wrong way, it might be good to stop for a while and be open to help, even if there doesn't seem to be any help. Like maybe we look up and suddenly we remember that's the North Star and I want it to go south, or even though we thought we'd forgotten about the North Star and we'd forgotten that south was the direction. It might just click when we need it. Or maybe someone in our caravan says, I was just wondering when you finally ask. So one time I was crossing a desert, and it was a high altitude desert, just to make it more interesting, on the Tibetan plateau, but not in Tibet, in the Indian side, which is called Ladakh. Being in Ladakh for me was like being inside God. That I think being so high, the air being so thin, everything had a surreal but really crisp quality. And that might be why I made the really stupid decision of, why don't we just walk down from this high altitude desert to the juicy, rainy mountains of Manali? Someone else is doing it. So my partner at the time and I had made friends with a woman named India from Spain who was going to walk from Leh to Manali. And it seemed like, and it is actually a really ridiculous thing to do. Without any tent, like no like big water bottle or anything, regular water bottle. Food, no. Map, no. little maps in the guidebook that are of Leh, the city. And one of my great hesitations, small doubts about telling the story is that you would think you would never do that, and that's what I would think too if you were telling the story. I would never do that. And then we were walking along, and a few people did do this, but more often people would hitch rides because the public transportation up there is so infrequent and packed. So people would hitch rides with different kinds of transportation that might go by, which was mostly, because it's on this border that's very contested, it was mostly our favorite way of hitching ride in an army truck. So one truck passed, and because India said, no, I'm going to walk, we're like, okay, we're going to walk too. And then no trucks passed for a really long time. And India had told us all these stories about how she'd walked here and there all across Ladakh and loved how she never saw anyone. And then she'd come to the village and they would invite her in and feed her, you know, the Ladakhi stew and called skew. Then she would move on the next day. So we weren't coming on any villages. And another army truck passed, and my boyfriend and I took the ride, and India didn't. Bye, India. And so there were four of us along the front bench, and I mean bench, like hard bench, of this truck. And it was fun. It was fine. It was illegal also, by the way. Like, the army guys weren't supposed to take passengers, hitchers. So whenever any other army truck would go by, we would have to hide, either by stopping and hiding behind a tire or like getting down under the metal dashboard. I don't like to do illegal things. Some people like to do that kind of thing. I really don't like to do this kind of thing. Then we got to the army camp, which we shouldn't go into the army camp in the army truck. So they let us off a little bit before, and then they said, but you could sleep in the army truck since it's going to be so cold tonight, since it's a desert. And the army truck is parked in the army camp. And these are all things I would never do. So we're trying to sleep. We didn't sleep, but we were trying to sleep in the army truck in the army camp where we weren't supposed to be. And then the really jolly, friendly two army guys came back after their supper. And with supper in the army, you get a digit of hard alcohol as a daily ration. And they had had theirs. I think Gyan might be calling. Maybe he sees the woodchuck. Katora, he can just come. He can come with a car if that's what needs to be. I don't know if I want him to hear this story. I better hurry up. Part of why I'm telling the story is the metaphor of crossing a desert, and part of it is the times when you're in that kind of situation, whether inner or outer, where it just seems to be getting worse and worse, and there doesn't seem to be a way out. So the army guys came back with the particular fragrance of alcohol in their breaths and a particular slur of alcohol in the speech, and they said, oh, well, we've just found out that the pass is closed, so you can't go on towards Manali. You're going to have to come back with us to Leh and get a ride around through Kashmir, which is where there's all this civil unrest. So we're like, cool. And then they went back to their tent and we were in this cold truck. And we had good sleeping bags. The metal door was still really cold through the sleeping bag, but we had water. We had some food. And we started more and more also having this very wise doubt, I think, about whether the army officers were telling the truth or not. So was the pass closed or not? And we talked about it, and we decided to try sleeping in the truck a little bit longer. And we would decide in the early morning if we would do what they asked us to do, which was go before light, sneak out of the truck, sneak out of the army camp, and go around a few of those hairpin bends that had led to the army camp and hide and wait. Ridiculous. So we tried to sleep, and what I started to feel was heat in my belly and nausea, like I was about to vomit or pass out. And so I did the second one. Not that I did it on purpose, but I did pass out. Which I couldn't have managed to do on purpose, but I'm really glad it happened. Because then came a clear experience of what a human being is. And again, it was another of the small doubts why I didn't want to tell the story, because you might then think that I'm some amazing person. It just happened out of need that I experienced what we are, which is like much taller than our body, like way, way up there. I could easily see or sense that the pass was open. And that's all I needed to know. So then all the kind of layers of person were chosen, so to say, to come back. Male or female? Where on the planet? Which army truck? So just to have the sense that those layers, including like name and gender, are kind of like what I mentioned in the John de Reuter quotation interaction from yesterday. What seemed to be the most important event of our life, I got pregnant, so we got married. That's superficial. And there's something deeper that has and could have more presence in our life. That's as tall as it needs to be to see what needs to be seen. So then I was there again. I was a woman in that high altitude desert with that man, with that name, in that truck, with that problem and that clarity. And so we got out of the truck and we went the other way. We didn't go back towards Leh. We went towards Manali walking, and we slept behind a rock. And we just woke up in time to hear and see a truck go by. And India was inside along with about 20 other foreigners, not stopping for us. She probably thought we wanted to walk. Let's hope that that's what was going on, because they didn't stop. And it was the last truck that went through for 3 days. So we walked, and there was the next army tent, which was not an army camp, but the army check post. Because it's a border area. I'm having these really funny slips of tongue. There's going to be order barrier. A border area. That's a barrier that you have to stop and go through this process of writing out. Or it's actually worse than that. Having someone else write out for you everything in your passport by hand into a big book. And even if the person's not so great at English, because why should he be? He's from some small town in Rajasthan. You don't want him to feel embarrassed while he's writing your name. And you can't be in a hurry, even if you really need to pee or whatever. So this was the tent where that truck had stopped before us and left without us. Thanks, India. And then we were there with these other army guys who also got their finger of hard alcohol every night, sleeping in the same tent. The head guy, I might mention, because he was the head guy, also got his assistant's finger of alcohol every evening. He got like double. And his very kind assistant told us to go to sleep really, really, really early and stay asleep no matter what, so that there would be no interaction in the drunkenness. And it just came to my mind, because it needed to really clearly, that it was going to be 3 days. No one knew when the next truck was coming, but it was, I knew, I don't know how I knew, but I knew that it was going to be 3 days before we got out of there, which seemed impossible for me, with my history, to sleep in an army tent with a drunk guy who thinks of himself as powerful, and so does everyone around him. There was another truck that came through, but that same guy didn't put us in it, and everyone got really mad at him for not doing his duty. And then the next truck came, and we got in, and we bounced down from 10,000 feet, and then back up to 12,000 feet, and then back down. Along the way, the army guys in the back of the truck with us, that we were all back there like sacks of potatoes. They had guns. We didn't. Got into arguments with people at the restaurants we stopped at for supper, and they were throwing rocks at each other, and we're just like getting into the truck. Not freaking out. And sometimes saying something also. When we got out in Manali, we got out near a hot springs called Vishisht Hot Springs. Our faces were black because we were sitting at the back of the truck where the exhaust was coming for those 36 hours. Imagine our lungs. Our clothes and our everything was black from the smoke of the truck. So the whole time, all the small doubts or the anxiety or the self-blame of what on earth were you thinking? And this other crystalline, unshakable knowing what needed to be known, and that's all that needed to be known. Their pass is open, and the next truck is in 3 days. And don't freak out, by the way. If we could have the same kind of fortitude with the inner army officers, the inner drunkenness, all of those different chemical addictions, anxiety, anger, blame, sadness, etc. If we could know when to just get down and pretend to be asleep in your sleeping bag, when to say something occasionally. And how to never do that again. Sometimes it's like that person in a story about a kingdom or a queendom, so a village with village walls, and everyone within the village walls drank from the same well. And someone one day put something in the well that made people crazy. And they sold it as the hottest new thing. And so it went first to the king. Or the queen. And then everybody wanted to try it. And there was just one person left who hadn't drunk the water, who lived in within those walls. That's the great doubt person. Are you just going to drink the water so you can get along? Or are you, what are you going to do? Not freaking out, what do you need to know? And feeling that different quality of knowing what you need to know and that it is enough even if it seems like not. That sometimes there are deserts that come along. And there is a possibility of crossing them with no damage to our person or property. And we'll be glad. And when we come across the desert, if we can really take stock of our experience to really remember the different kinds of doubt and what they feel like, and when we've crossed the desert and come out, and all of us are okay, if we can let the sense impressions be released. Because it's a really then good moment to get on with it, full steam. Not pressing forward, not postponing, but falling in. Is there anything someone wants to say or ask? One of them. There's trauma. There's also what's happened so many times that could be completely neutral, but it's happened so many times that it has kind of it's kind of set up shop. So when we experience, let's say, a certain color many, 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 many times, then if it's neutral or positive experiences around that color, then that color for us becomes a good color. There's a liking of the color that's extra to experiencing the color and extra to intimacy with the color. So it can be where there was intensity, or there can be where there was duration. And then accumulation, and then it gets in the way. So just a few moments quiet together, moments literally. What is it that you know, that you need to know? That one thing, that seemingly little thing, that's enough. A kind of crystalline knowing that you didn't make up, that happened to you. Letting that be the crown jewel.